Talk given Sunday, 4th January, 1976. If we are truly concerned with religion and with living the religious life, that would be our one and only care, permeating our whole life. We would not care for anything else. We must understand this in depth. To be interested in the deep sense and to care for religion and the religious life means to care for the whole of life. Because the context of religion is totality, is all existence. Religion is not a part of life. It is the whole of life. And I say this because it is a fact that the religious drive within us, whether we recognize it or not, is one which continuously moves us onwards to realization of the total purpose of our particular existence in the world. For most people, religion means subscribing to certain doctrines and dogmas, to professing certain creeds regarding what people commonly call matters spiritual, to trying to live a good life in the usual moral, social sense, and so forth. And they are unaware of the fact that religion in itself is something immensely greater than this. As I say, its context is totality. Its context is transcendence itself. Transcendence not as an other than something which is not transcendent, but transcendence in the sense that it includes the totality, altogether includes the totality. So, if we really care for religion and the religious life, it means that we truly care with all our being for the whole of our life, every single aspect of it. And it does not mean, therefore, that what we, through our shortcomings, conceive of as religion in the restricted sense, has to be applied to each and every other branch of life. If every aspect of our ordinary life, our physical life, our food and drink, our rest and work and sleep and business, our study and thinking and social relationships and everything, if every one of those is imbued with the religious spirit. Then, although the techniques involved in the different aspect of life are all techniques which belong to their own particular sphere, they will all be religiously carried out. Which means, essentially, fundamentally, we shall live practically. Whatsoever is practical comes to fruition. And as and when one is wholly practical, it means perfection. So, to care for religion means not to care for anything else, because everything else is included in religion. When we are aware of our life and existence in terms of compartments, this is housework, this is business, this is government, this is something else. When we compartment life in that manner, we are splitting our minds into so many fragments. Now the fact of the mind is that the mind functions as a whole only, and it can function only as a whole. But because out of our ignorance we split the mind up in this way, we attempt to break up that which in itself is essentially unbreakable. And so the consciousness of otherness spoils our daily living process. So we say, this is religion, this is mysticism, this is yoga, this is so and so, and all the rest of it. And this is one of the fundamental mistakes we make, is it not? We say very glibly, we live in a universe. But we behave and function as if we lived in a multiverse, not a universe. A universe is a single unitary whole. This one, this total one, is composed of the multitudinous many. But the marvel of the universe is that whilst each and every one of the many is unique and wonderful in itself, it is completely interrelated with the totality of the universe. It is only man who is unaware of that relationship. And therefore he functions fragmentarily, because not being aware in terms of wholeness, he splits up everything and therefore misses the relationships, and in the missing of the relationships engenders conflict, sorrow, frustration, grief, and is just caught in the senseless pursuit of mere pleasure, believing it to be happiness, or in the pursuit of this, that, or the other cultural activity, thinking this way he can compensate himself for what he has lost, or he can sublimate such and such urges. Surely all this is erroneous, is it not? If one can sense the wholeness of things all the time, then the whole of oneself lives in the immediate now. And whatever the immediate now puts in front of one, one deals with it in terms of wholeness, and therefore in terms of all the interrelationships of that particular thing with everything else. You don't have to consciously hold in your mind the interrelationships of your cabbages or your meat and so on, which you are cooking with the totality of the universe. The brain would just crack under the strain of attempting to do that. It is the spirit in which oneself as a whole approaches the particular. You get the point. Our present mode of awareness is a fragmentary mode. That has to undergo this extraordinary transformation by which it becomes the mode of unitary wholeness. And that means holiness. And that means humanness. Never forget the true meaning of that word, human. The happy creator. The Sanskrit root man, usually translated as to think. And that's not enough. It does not mean think in our dictionary meaning of the word. That is its most degraded meaning. To think in this sense is to create, to mind. Our word mind and our word man comes from that root, Sanskrit root man, meaning to create fundamentally. It represents this mysterious, unknown, ultimate energy of the universe, which is the energy that is creative action in eternity, of which we are conscious in terms of the making, the producing of innumerable particulars in the process of time. You see, the truth is that, but that is the truth of all this which we dimly interpret, which we actually misinterpret in terms of separateness and a time process. Therefore we know birth and procedure and death and all that is involved in this round. But if we become aware, conscious, really conscious in terms of a wholeness, the same events will take place and so forth, but with a great difference. The fundamental difference will be that we shall be free of this uncontrollable reactivity to everything that comes our way. We shall be able, in terms of wholeness, to make the right response. Because if the awareness of wholeness is dominant in us, whatsoever comes to us undergoes a process within mind and consciousness and goes out as an influence which is integrative, constructive. Without our knowing how and why, without our needing to attempt to preconceive the constructive action. In other words, our activity, our daily activity, is a perfect activity because perfect activity is now natural and spontaneous to us. It has not got to be thought out. Whatsoever has to be thought out is everlastingly subject to our own personal conditioning, to our own personal psychical and mental, our psychological defilements, weaknesses, drawbacks, etc. And in any case, it is always caught within this enclosed sphere of ambivalence, which is the sphere of mortality and not of life everlasting. The truth of life is its eternity. The unhappiness of life is our awareness in terms of a time process for life. But be conscious in terms of wholeness, and eternity will be embodied in every single passing moment of time. And if one awakes to that and gives oneself completely to it, unquestioningly, then the tyranny of time is over. There is no grasping to preserve that which is here and now in this moment of time. Because life is an everlastingly moving thing. It never stays still. And remember, life never moves to a goal which you or I can preconceive. You and I can't preconceive these goals. But the process of fruition is a reality. And each individual, each one of you, I myself, every one of us, can move towards this fruition because we are swimming with life in itself, which is creative action in eternity. I know that these at first will just be so many words. Perhaps one may raise up certain thoughts about it. But they are all temporary. They belong to the realm of birth and death. Don't hold on to the words. Don't hold on to the thoughts. Awake to the living reality in them, which is beyond expression in terms of thought and speech. And this, of course, is the really difficult task. But this particularly is specifically the human task. This is what makes us human. Not this ordinary process of thinking and systematizing and so on, which belongs to the brain insofar as it is concerned with the past, with the already known, with the already established. But whatsoever is the already so and so is not here now. It is dead. Now, it is dead in this sense that the form in which it took, that the shape which it took at the time when it happened, is what we cling to in our memory. We cling to a fossil, a mental fossil, a thing with no power. It's impotent. That thing of the past, undergoing the transforming process of evolution and of development, is the immediate now. And in that sense, the entire past is alive now, but not in the shapes which it took coming into the now. And our memories hold the shapes only, the dead shapes, the ghosts. We play with ghosts when we play with memory. And by doing that, we are unable to attend fully and completely to the immediate now. Now it is very important to understand this. Don't just try and grasp the thought. Understand it. Understanding is a living, creative activity within oneself. Understand it. Because if we understand it, we will then really begin to appreciate the immeasurable importance of complete attentiveness. We are, as we go through life, like children in a class who are perhaps not interested in the subject or the way the teacher is presenting the subject, and they are chasing red Indians and goodness knows what in their imagination whilst the teacher is talking away about Henry VIII or about algebra or chemistry. That's what we are like in the course of our lives. We imagine we are attending to something. Consider, for example, how we say, oh, 12 o'clock, oh, I must get on with the cooking now. Part of your attention is there. And where is the rest of your attention? What are you thinking of? What are you feeling? Precisely how is this chatterbox brain chattering away, 100 to the dozen, whilst you are automatically going through the motions of cooking? But give your whole attention to it. If you can give your whole attention to it, what will happen? There will be the absence of an isolative, a separative I consciousness. I've got to do this, I am doing this. This I, which the mind sets up, is a myth altogether. It is non-existence, non-existent. There's no such thing as I. Analyze it. Look into it quietly when you're feeling at ease, when you're feeling in the right mood for it. There is no such thing as this I. But if you attend completely to the whole thing, this I, which always wants to draw the world unto itself only, is absent. When the I is absent, your activity is natural, it is spontaneous, and your technique is as perfect as it can possibly be. And that is the state of real communion. You are in complete communion with your action. And through that communion, because you are in complete communion with the particular, you are also in complete communion with the totality of the world. The I consciousness is not obtruding itself upon the universal harmony. And there is unbroken holiness everywhere, insofar as you, the living person, are concerned. So, your action will be one which will be an activity of pure love, of pure intelligence. It will be true, it will be good, it will be the best possible in the actual situation. This is the meaning of caring for religion with your whole being. It includes everything. And your attentiveness being complete, the mind and consciousness which is directed towards that particular action is no longer merely your own mind and consciousness with all its confusions, its uncertainties, its difficulties, its fragmentariness, and the rest of it. It is the mind which is the total mind at play. Look at it like this. We know that our own bodies, which we quite rightly call material bodies, are a particular pattern of the total materiality of the universe. The matter of the universe, patterned this way, is named Firoz Mehta. Patterned that way has another name. Patterned that way is called a piano. Patterned this way is called a book. And so on and so on. It's the same matter of the universe. The same protons and electrons and neutrons and all the other ons. That's all. And each one of those fundamental particles, so to say, have no name, no label. An electron composing the matter of a book, or of you, or of that cat, or this microphone, is absolutely unidentifiable if separated out of that pattern. All the different metals that we know, all the different elements that we know, their difference is completely gone in this non-identity state of the fundamental reality. Now, in that same way, what we commonly call my mind is a particular patterning out of universal mind. And mind you can regard as an indescribable, unknown energy, fundamental energy. When mind confluences body, because of the hereditary blueprint of the body, the particular type of brain and ductless glands and all the rest of it, mental processes which that psychophysical organism displays are your particular psyche. Otherwise, there is just mind, this unknown mysterious energy. Now, if any part of the body does not function rightly, that is to say, function in harmony with all the other parts of the body is ill. Now the same with the mind. When the mind is ill, we experience fear, anger, hatred, resentment, confusion, all sorts of things like that. When the mind is healthy, when it is whole, integrated, then that mind everlastingly is an influence which is recognized as love, as wisdom, as truth, or goodness, or beauty, and so forth. Now, the key, the supreme instrument of salvation that we have, salvation in the sense of making whole, making healthy, salving, see, the supreme instrument which we have is our power of attentiveness. If we attend, and that is our responsibility, our particular responsibility. If we use this power of attentiveness in the total, complete way, then all these changes take place. And this is one of the deepest meanings of yoga. What is yoga about? Yoga is concerned with bringing the individual to his own unique fruition. It is concerned with restoring the individual as a separate organism to a state of complete harmony within itself as a psychophysical organism, and much more than that. That is only the beginning, the kindergarten part of it. Much more than that. Restoring this organism to complete an harmonious relationship with totality, then that particular psychophysical organism, the man called John Smith, the woman called Mary Brown, is a true individual, an undividable, not merely an indivisible within oneself, a harmony within oneself, but a conscious harmony in relationship with the total universe. This is what man can realize. And this, perhaps, is one way of regarding the purpose of our existence. We are one of the kingdoms of nature on the face of the earth. Within us is this extraordinary awareness of selfness. It's only you and I, human beings, who can recognize a withinness. That cat, for example, or any other animal, or a tree, is unaware of withinness. The animal world, the plant world, reacts exactly according to the forces at play acting upon it. And therefore, all the kingdoms, apart from man himself, are in unconscious harmony with the whole. But in man, this harmony has to grow into a conscious harmony. Man has consciousness as no animal or plant has. Man has mind as no animal or plant has. And certainly the earth or the stone or whatever it is. This is our specific task. And it is a task that will necessarily take a long period of time for mankind to wake up to this. Means that the time process will bring about that wealth of experience and understanding and so forth, which in its fruition will mark all mankind as an organism that has completely woken up to its relationship with totality and is in harmony in terms of thought and feeling, of speech and action with that totality. And this is the fundamental purpose of yoga. You know how yoga is generally presented as consisting of eight limbs, as they say. You'll find this way back in the Upanishads. You look at the Shandilya Upanishad, you look at several of the other Upanishads too. They will all teach about the eight limbs of yoga. The first two establish the basic morality, the yamas and the niyamas. Then comes the discipline of the body, which consists of the postures and the breathing. Now, the purpose of the postures, the training in postures, fundamentally is just this. The body is the basic source of the distraction of the mind. The energies within the body, what we call the natural urges, are our heritage right from our primordial ancestor, the original primate, through evolution over several million years now. It's our natural heritage. Now, this heritage is an animal heritage. If we were to remain as pure animals, we would be wholly good and proper. But within us has also emerged this awareness of withinness. I, myself, I can say. No animal can say, I, myself, as separate from you, yourself. But you and I can do that. And in this I, myselfness, is the root source of trouble and difficulty. This was the fall of Adam, if you like. He fell from the contemplation of divinity, of God. He was on speaking terms with God, wasn't he? Before the woman gave him the apple, not his wife. Hava, Eve, his wife, comes later into the story. But the feminine aspect of this creative energy of the universe is the one which stirs the organism, the human organism, to wake up to self-consciousness. And the human organism, not being sufficiently developed in various respects, becomes vaguely aware of the incarnate immanence within himself and is unable to adjust himself to that first awareness. And therefore, he becomes conscious of the withinness in terms of separateness and says, I, and adds to that, both consciously and unconsciously, I am not you. This is his fundamental trouble, the root of all his conflict, the root of his confusions and misery and so forth. So this is what happened in the course of evolution. So this natural heritage, the animal heritage as such, which is pure and good in itself, when dealt with by this separative self-consciousness, produces all the trouble. That's one aspect of the story. The other aspect is our socio-cultural heritage. This mind, which has run away, so to say, with our development process, particularly in one way, the super development of the brain, as compared with the development of the other aspects of our being. The mind is immature, never comes to maturity, excepting in a few rare cases. The body comes to maturity by the time we are 25, 30 at most, and so forth. But whose mind ever comes to maturity? You can count them on your fingers' ends. Now, this is a totally different thing, because the maturing of the mind depends upon the awakening in innermost awareness to the real nature of our being and our environment and our interrelationships with it. That is what it implies. So now, the body therefore puts out its urges, and the mind misinterprets them and seeks pleasure for oneself and tries to push out all that is displeasing to us. But what are our criteria of pleasure and pain, of the desirable and the undesirable, of the good and the bad? All our criteria are false criteria. And there will always be false criteria, however learned we become, however knowledgeable we become, for one very simple reason. We are conscious only in terms of separate I-ness. How many of us are conscious in terms of everybody present? Is there a sense of us so complete, so natural and flawless, that whatsoever is happening to you is also happening to me? I am in complete sympathy as well as empathy with you. When two people really love each other, and I'm sure all of you must have experienced that sometime in your life in relationship to somebody, when there is this real oneness, what has happened? Two obviously separate organisms are no longer separate in innermost awareness. How often have true husband and wife, or any two people who truly love each other, sort of had the same thought, the same feeling? They are aware simultaneously. That sense of usness, when that sense of usness has really come to flower, then there is no conflict between me and you. None whatever. How to bring the mind to this state? This is the fundamental concern of yoga. So first of all, the basis of the moralities, the virtues as we call them, in their lesser state, the ambivalent state, and then this discipline of the body, so that the body will not interfere with the process of attending. Usually they say with the process of meditation. I prefer to use the term the process of attending, because you see, the word meditation unfortunately has been sadly reduced to a ritual talking process in the mind at a certain time of the day in a certain place. This is not meditation. Meditation means the state of total communion all the time. Meditation is a thing of eternity, not of time. Meditation means that you are completely in communion all the time, which must not be restricted just to the conscious part of you, not at all. That communion, the lighted part of that communion, if you like, is the conscious part. But the whole of the unconscious, no longer unruly, no longer disharmonious, is also in communion at the same time. The whole of you is moving with the stream of life eternal. That is the meaning of meditation. So you see, the body interferes with the act of attending. If you take the specific practice of meditation, you sit, you say, I am going to sit down for meditation. To your horror, you find all sorts of rumblings in your stomach coming up, which never came up before. You find yourself itching and you want to scratch here, and you suddenly start sneezing, and you suddenly start doing everything, you see. It's very much like all the unruly children in a class, you know, who start fidgeting and making a nuisance of themselves. And the body does precisely that. A whole crowd of naughty children about. Now, the asanas, the postures, this has been discovered experimentally through the centuries, are of such a nature that they bring about nervous calm, first and foremost. None of the yogic postures are calculated to make you a 250,000-pound rugby player, or a heavyweight champion boxer, or a fellow who can run a mile in 2.5 minutes or some such thing. None of them do that. They are not concerned with that. They are not concerned with personal achievement. They are not concerned with making you healthy and getting rid of your ailments and this, that and the other, of beautifying you, or of enabling you to get success in competition with your neighbor. These are the very things that are absolute anathema to yoga. This is the very opposite of unification, of harmonizing, of purification. The self has come in and interfered with the whole significance and the holiness of a physical discipline which is intended to release total harmony. So, the asanas, with that attitude, with that approach to it, that understanding of it, the release from bondage to selfness, the pranayama, the breathing. Now be very careful about this. You really must study your Upanishads in detail, otherwise you'll run away with the wrong ideas and so forth to start with, and make awful mistakes and suffer physically too. Pranayama. Yama is disciplining. Disciplining in rather a intense sense, in the sense of mortification. Now be careful. I said mortification. The mortification of selfness. Prana means life, and prana means life in its totality, its complete mystery, as well as its particular manifestation in its concretest and its, I'm going to use the word lowest, but not in a pejorative sense, in its lowest form, namely the breath, the breathing. Because unless the body breathes, it will die. So now, pranayama is the disciplining of the life process, of your own individual life process, of which rhythmic breathing and the control of breath and all that is just the simplest, the real kindergarten stage. The disciplining of the life process, the living process, that is pranayama. Which way is my life moving? It is my business to be awake to it, to attend to it, to be aware of it, and see, and be so mindful that I see that I am in tune with life, the trends of life, not life as the world defines it. Leave all worldly knowledge and considerations aside. Look right within. And you can look right within if you let yourself be quiet. And letting yourself be quiet means perhaps above all, discarding what is already known. That does not mean to say that what is already known is false, not at all, not necessarily. Much of it is false, but there is a part of the known which is true. But that truth, that kernel, that essence, has to be discovered within oneself when it becomes a living force for good, for growth, for fruition, for swimming with the stream of life. Now, if you are quiet in that sense from within, then the real pranayama is taking place. Remember those words in the Chandogya Upanishad, wonderful teaching. Brahman is prana. The absolute all, the totality, the transcendent reality is prana, life, of which the least manifestation, right down at our concrete level, is breathing. So those four, the yamas, the niyamas, the moral basis business, the asanas and the pranayama, the disciplining of the whole organism, part of it, is the preparation for what is called the pratyahara, dharana, dhyana and samadhi. And pratyahara is usually translated, and I do not like the translation, as withdrawal of the senses from the objects of sense. I say quite categorically, it does not mean that as translated in English. Pratyahara means the use, the complete and perfect use, the trained use of the senses, all the senses, in relationship to all the objects of sense, without becoming attached, without experiencing aversion from the objects of sense, without the arising of excited desire in relationship to the process of sense living. Then we are free of every form of sensuality. But we live in terms of the perfect sensuousness, the perfect sensitivity, which goes right into the deeps of consciousness and puts us in complete harmony with the totality around us. See, this is the meaning of pratyahara. Then dharana, again rather badly translated, and even in the Upanishads very poorly spoken of. There are just a few statements here and there. Just look at the simple root meaning of dharana, derived from the word dhri, the root is dhri. Dhri means to uphold. What do you uphold? The falling roof? Or the communist order? Or a fascist system? What do you uphold? Or conventional orthodox religious morality and creeds and beliefs and all the rest of it? They all belong to the realm of death. You uphold Ritta. And the teaching about Ritta comes right the way back from our primordial religious documents, the Rig Veda and the Kabbalah. Ritta means the eternal order of the cosmos. The order, not in terms of shape and form, the planets going round regularly and all that, not that. Order in the sense of the power for harmony inherent in every single thing that there is in the universe. It's an actual energy, an actual power for maintaining a state of harmony for everything in the universe. That is Ritta, our English word rite, R-I-T-E, and ritual is derived from Ritta. And Dharana means the upholding of that. And to what do we ascribe that Ritta? To this unknown, mysterious, creative power in the universe that brings cosmos into being and makes it move in the ways of beauty and perfection. That is Ritta. So Dharana is to uphold that. Now how will you and I try to uphold it? In one word, by virtue. Not virtue in its restricted, ambivalent sense, good and bad, kind and cruel, and all that sort of stuff, but in its transcendental sense, in the sense of a transcendental ethic, the absoluteness of love and wisdom and truth and so forth, which you cannot define. The moment you define it, and the moment you find definitions as such coming up in your mind in relation to these things, then know that it is not the transcendent real, it is the shadow of it. It is the ghost of the transcendent real. But in absolute terms, this is how it happens. Then comes dhyana, attention, to attend to something is dhyana. What will your attention be like under these circumstances? You see, you will attend to everything as God attends to the universe, as God attends to nature and nature attends to God. The masculine, feminine serve each other in terms of perfect harmony. Nature serves God in the manner which is complementary to the manner in which God, by sheer presence, inspires nature, and the whole process of nature brings cosmos into being. These are things which happen inside our very bodies. Don't forget that. But you see, it is you and I who, out of ignorance, who out of willfulness, out of being caught in this unhappy trap of the pursuit of pleasure and the expression of self as against the world, as separate from the world, it is because of all that that we never wake up to this transcendent reality within us. When you do begin to wake up, all conceit on the one hand, all pride and so on, and modesty and humility, this defined modesty and humility, they all disappear. All the qualities caught within the sphere of ambivalence just completely disappear. And you live naturally, spontaneously, the full-fledged human being, the perfected Holy One, the individual, the undivided within yourself, the undivided from the whole, the holiness, This is man's fulfillment. It's an extraordinary thing. Don't attempt to make it a goal. Don't try to achieve it. Because if you desire to achieve, if you desire to attain, then it is always an I involved in it, a separate I wanting to attain. It is transcendence itself which comes to fruition within you. And that is the state of the Supreme Samadhi. When there is God alone and no me interfering with God.